Facebook a few minutes ago.
Granddaughter.
Oh, granddaughter. Oh, yeah. That's right, because I saw pictures of your son holding your granddaughter. That's right. Really adorable.
Very, very cool name. I love the name. It's going to... They were going to... Her name is Sutton, but they were going to call her the Irish name Maeve, M-A-E-V-E.
Yeah, that's a nice name. Yeah.
And they decided, or I guess they both decided that there were too many other people. They did some research, and that was like a very trending name, and so they didn't want to be part of a big mob. So.
Yeah. Names go in cycles. It's kind of funny. Like you can look it up by decade.
Yeah.
Like in the 50s and 60s, Marilyn was the most popular female name, I think. And, you know, well, that's, so Sutton is her name, huh?
Yep.
Cool.
Well, here's a... I thought we could start by, first of all, the... Let's just make sure that I am remembering correctly for the sake of this podcast or recording that it's called The Whole Dern... Jeez, excuse me, Joe, I'm sorry. It slipped out of my head. It's The Whole Dern...
Human Comedy.
The Whole Dern Human Comedy, right. And that is,
yeah,
of course...
Yeah, that's a line from Big Lebowski, that, right. You know, the Sam Elliott character says that.
Sitting at the bar at the bowling alley, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and then the subtitle is Life According to the Coen Brothers, where the, right. They spell out the word brothers and then don't abbreviate it there in the title. But I like that phrase. Balzac, you know, is the guy who called his work the Human Comedy, and that's right. A nice... I mean, they're very literary, the Coen Brothers. They said in some interview that people are always looking for film references in their works, but their main influences, they said, are literary. They mentioned Flannery O'Connor, James M. Cain, and Raymond Chandler, the three influences, they said.
Mm. I was thinking about the type of comedy that makes the Coens laugh. I said when I saw A Serious Man... when I interviewed them in Toronto, right when the Serious Man was, and I said it reminded me, personally, of the Kiki joke. They didn't know what I was referring to, but they had a different name for it. You're probably heard a variation upon this about the anthropologists captured by savages in somewhere in the Southeast Asia, South Pacific, and being... Yeah. One of the guys being told, you have two choices, death or Kiki. And the guy says, well, okay, I'll take Kiki. And that, of course, introduces all sorts of horrible tortures. And then he finally is killed by being thrown to a pit of alligators. The second guy is told the same thing, death or Kiki. And he says... well, I'm not a brave man, and I obviously know what Kiki is, so I will choose death. And the chief of the tribe says, death? Okay, very well. Death it is. But first, Kiki! Now, that made Joel really laugh. He thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, right.
And that is kind of what...
You could make a movie out of that.
You could make a...
Coen Brothers film. Yeah.
But they more or less agreed, the two of them, that that's kind of what the Serious Man is saying. I mean, because there's a, that, you know, if God doesn't like you, if God takes a, has an attitude about you and doesn't care, you're fucked no matter what, is what the movie is basically saying.
Yeah, some people really get mad about that film, but I found it, it's a complex film. I spend more time on that film than any other film of theirs, except for Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and I think my views of Serious Man have kind of evolved over time, you know.
What was your first reaction?
Well, I liked it a lot the first time, and then the second time I liked it less, and then now I like it a lot again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really the Book of Job, and I went back and read the Book of Job, and one point I make in the book is that nobody criticizes the Book of Job for being too dark, you know. But when the Coen brothers do it, they get attacked. I know certain people really hate that film because it's so dark. Like the tornado coming at the end, I think is a wonderful test.
That is a hilarious ending. I think that's one of the best endings. It's second only to the ending of No Country. which I think is
wonderful. Yeah, that's an incredible, wonderful ending. I mean, my gosh, that's so great. The speech he gives, you know, I mean, that's one of the most moving scenes I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I know some people really don't like that ending because they don't get it, I think. They get upset because it confuses them, but it's quite clear to me. I mean, it's a, you know, it's about his vision of death and going to be with his father in death, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And it's, but it's also about, I mean, you know, that guy and the man in the serious man are connected because they're trying to make sense out of the craziness of the world and existence and the unfairness of fate. I mean, that's, I think we all live with that, but some people don't want to deal with that or don't want to think about it, I guess, you know.
There has never been a Pollyannic sincere sentiment in any Coen Brothers films, and either you understand the humor of what they're, the black humor of it, or you don't. You can't teach people to understand that, I don't think.
No, I think that's the key to why they're controversial, and the same with Billy Wilder. I see the Coens as the contemporary heirs to Billy Wilder, or the sons of Billy Wilder, in a sense, because he was criticized for similar things, for being allegedly too cynical, and then, you know, I have the quote in the book. I used that word with him once without thinking, and he said, "But if I'm cynical, what attitude do you have for Peckinpah pictures?" But but I think that. But he said all. But he said every play by Ibsen is cynical. Every play by Strindberg is cynical. But the Coen brothers and Wilder, I guess maybe this reflects my taste. It certainly does, because why would I write a book about them, both Wilder and the Coen brothers? Mm-hmm. I see them as disappointed idealists, and I see Kubrick that way too. I mean, people say he's a misanthrope, but I think he's a man who, you know, has a core of idealism that is deeply disappointed in.
Yeah.
And you know, actually now I'm thinking of something else. John Huston is like that too, and he's got very dark endings to his films. Like Treasure of the Sierra Madre, where the gold all blows away and they laugh, you know.
Well, actually, that's kind of a joyous ending in a way, about accepting the human frailty or the human comedy as comedy, and not being so downhearted about it.
Yeah, not being destroyed. Hemingway had that line that man can be destroyed but not defeated, which is a great line. I'm sorry, I got it backwards. Man can be defeated but not destroyed. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're
I like the other way. I like the original.
Yeah, well, they're both good. You could argue both, but you know, it actually makes me think of a line that Huston said once about God. Somebody asked him if he believed in God, and he said he did, but he thought that what happened with the world was that God created human beings out of love, and then we disappointed him, and he lost interest in us, and that explains why there's such evil in the world. Like, you know, people think about the Holocaust. How could it be a God if that happened?
Mm-hmm.
And Huston's answer was, God just lost interest in the human race after a while. That's one way to look at it.
Before we step into the book, I wanted to just ask you, because you teach a lot, and I'm sure you've gotten into the Coen brothers with your students, and I was wondering what your sense of the reception to the understanding or enthusiasm for the Coens amongst Zoomers, or do they not care, or what's your sense of it?
Well, no, I think they're among the contemporary filmmakers who are really younger viewers really appreciate and understand. Certainly Big Lebowski was taken up by the younger generation. Of course, that's already about, 20 plus years ago.
98.
But they still watch it, you know, because it's one of those films that became a hit on tape and DVDs more than in the cinemas. Well, actually, it did pretty well in the theaters, but it's, you know, it's like Austin Powers became a hit on DVD.
Yeah.
And certain films to take off after a while. But no, I think the students really appreciate the Coen brothers. I see some differences in the students and our generation, because the students grew up in a totally crazy world, you know, after 9/11, and, you know, the whole last 22 years have been really insane. And, you know, I think our country's had a prolonged nervous breakdown, and we're still in it. And, you know, insane wars, you know, illegal wars for no purpose, and all kinds of terrible things happening. And they've kind of had to deal with that, and the Coen brothers deal with that kind of chaos in the background of life. How you persist, you know. So I think the students really appreciate them. And the thing with students is you have to bring them these films. You know, they don't. What I find strange is they don't even. And not only don't they see classic films on their own, most of them, this is generalizing, but most of them don't even see the current films. You know, I wonder why most film students are into the films, because when I first started teaching in 2002, you'd come in on Monday and say, what did you see over the weekend? And they'd talk about the current film, and now they don't even see the current film. You know, you look at them. I mentioned some of the big films recently, and they kind of give you a blank look. I don't know what they watch. I think part of it is they're watching stuff on YouTube and short things, you know. And
I was somebody features, said a few years ago that the kids don't go to the movies; they go to a movie, depending on you know. But they're certainly not in any habit. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, the whole habit audience died after World War II when TV came in, and, you know, the post-war baby boom, everybody got married and had children and stayed home and watched TV, and the whole habit thing died. But, you're right, they go to an event film, and Spielberg a few years ago kind of predicted that it would all become just a few big event films and then maybe a few smaller ones, but when you show them the great films from the past, they really appreciate them. Like I taught a course a couple times on Lubitsch and Wilder, and they love those films. When they see them, they're kind of amazed at how good these films are. Like you show Wilder's Ace in the Hole, which is as dark as any American film, you know. And Lubitsch's films are really sophisticated sexually, and they're kind of amazed that these films were made in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're not. They wouldn't find them on their own. Except for a few you run into the occasional hardcore film buff student, but not very often. Like in our generation, a lot of us were like that, you know.
My son, who's 33 now, he became a Wilder lover after seeing The Apartment in his mid-20s.
Great.
And his wife, Kate, has never seen a Wilder film, and he turned her on to The Apartment, and she loved it. But that's how it tends to go, I think. They're not particularly interested in, you know, seeing the what are regarded as the you know, the classic films. They just don't go. They don't care that much.
No, like, you know. When I first started teaching, I casually mentioned Annie Hall, and I was surprised nobody had seen Annie Hall. And I mean, I sort of assumed that everybody, you know, had seen the great classics like Casablanca, Annie Hall, but you can't assume that. But well, it's great that they love The Apartment. And actually, last semester, when I showed The Apartment, the students, that was, I think, their favorite Wilder film, because they all said, wow, it's so contemporary. It's just like, you know, sexual relationships and love relationships are today. I mean, they were really struck by how ahead of his time Wilder was. You know, he seems very contemporary.
Yeah.
But one thing Molly Haskell said when she gave me a blurb for my Wilder book, she said he ages well because he's not sentimental. You know, I think that's a good comment. And the Coens certainly are not sentimental, are they? I mean, they're very frank about confronting human nature. And
you're throwing Joe McBride, are throwing a softball at me that I have to ask you when you just said that about sentimentality not aging well. The name that comes up immediately is John Ford.
John Ford, I knew you were going to mention. Well, some of Ford is sentimental, but I think you have to distinguish between sentiment and sentimentality. Sentimentality is false sentiment, you know, and true sentiment, honest sentiment, like How Green Was My Valley or The Grapes of Wrath, is very powerful, I think, you know.
Mm.
Ford sometimes lapses into sentimentality, but I don't think as often as people think. I know you and I don't see eye to eye on that one, but Ford is my favorite director. He moves me a lot, but I mean, he has some pretty dark films in his canon, too. I mean, Seven Women, Cheyenne Autumn, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, you know.
I love Liberty. I'll always love Liberty Valance. The only thing I don't like about, not to be too digressive here, but the only thing I don't like about Liberty Valance is that you can always sense, often sense, that those Western streets and even the hold-up sequence with the stagecoach, you can tell it's shot on a soundstage because of the echoey sound.
Yeah, I don't mind that because Actually, you know, an interesting thing, when I was going through Ford's papers, I found a letter he wrote to Bosley Crowther, who was, you know, famously clueless. Ford, this is the only time in Ford's career that I'm aware of he wrote a letter to a critic before the film came out. And he said to Crowther, I made this film to look like a silent Western, and I wanted to not have, you know, beautiful landscapes. You know, I wanted to shoot it very simply and, you know, with simple sets and everything. And I think he did that on purpose, and then Crowther complained about it in his review anyway, as some of the other reviewers did. But to me, it's a film of ideas. It's not about beautiful landscapes. As a matter of fact, I think he went out of his way when they go out in the countryside to show really bleak landscape.
Yeah.
Because he was making a point. And it's like a Carl Dreyer film, in my opinion. The backgrounds are very stark. And, you know, everything is about the faces and the ideas in that film. I think it's a great screenplay and a great story. You know, that's why I think that works. You know, like The Searchers or something, you get seduced by the gorgeous landscapes and the color and everything. And Ford didn't want that in Liberty Valance.
Mm-hmm.
What are your favorite Coen films, by the way? I'm curious.
Well, certainly A Serious Man. I think more and more about that, particularly because of the way it ends, with the doctor giving him the call about, why don't you come in now and we can discuss the results and all that. Plus, Fagel outside with the cloud. It's just wonderful. I almost find that comedic, the way they present that. Secondly, or concurrently, would be No Country. And I guess, strangely, I mean, Lebowski, of course, but strangely, I really love Intolerable Cruelty because of the, it's much broader, the humor, but the tone is so masterful, the way it's, they hit the same kind of tonal note all through it. I think it's wonderful. And I like Burn After Reading, and...
I like that film a lot, too, and that's kind of neglected, but it did well at the box office, but you don't hear about it too much, but I think it's a very good film. Intolerable Cruelties, that's the kind of film I think Wilder would be making if he were around today.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a dark romantic comedy, you know, like The Apartment.
The way I kind of broke it down at one point, that there's two runs that they have, golden runs, if you will. There was the four-film run of the 80s and early 90s, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, which, by the way, I thought Raising Arizona, incidentally, was a hilarious script when I read it. And I thought, oh, this is going to be so great. It's so I can just see the scenes as I'm reading it. And then they overdid it. Comedicized it. They made it too flamboyant and too obvious and kind of, you know, winking at you the whole time. I didn't care for that film, oddly.
Yeah, that's not one of my favorites. And the whole thing with the biker and all seems to come out of nowhere. And it's kind of a mixed bag. But I think some of the humor with the idiotic couple is quite funny. I mean, they kind of fondly refer to their characters as a bunch of idiots. And you know, they actually love their idiot characters. And like Burn After Reading, those people are pretty idiotic. But there's kind of, that's kind of their vision of the human race, is we're all kind of, you know, flailing around in a sea of idiocy, and it's charming and funny. And Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is like that too.
Yeah.
But I think you're right that the early films they had some trouble controlling the tone, which they later mastered. You know, by the time they matured, their control of tone is really wonderful. I mean, but they really shift tone a lot, which bothers critics. And I found Truffaut once made the point about Shoot the Piano Player really bothered American reviewers, and I looked up Bosley Crowther's review, and I think that's what he was thinking of, because he said, this film is confusing because it's partly a romance, partly a comedy, and then there's tragedy, and you know, what's going on here? And Truffaut said American reviewers don't like films that mix genres and mix tones, and the Coens do that all the time. That's one of the things I like about them. I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, definitely. I hate it whenever any critic says, this movie doesn't know what it is. It's this, but it's also that. And therefore, the filmmaker, you know, is indecisive or mediocre. And that's can be the case, but it's assumed because it's mixed and it has these different tones. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad film, or that it's the filmmaker didn't know exactly what he or she was doing.
So. Yeah, and you know, I think sometimes when the Coens don't do that, they, you know, the films are less interesting. I find Miller's Crossing kind of an ordeal to watch because it's very grim and there's not a lot of comedy and it doesn't have that mixture of tones for me. I prefer, but on the other end, I mean, No Country for Old Men is very dark, but I know there's a kind of a dark, really dark humor, gallows humor, I guess you call it. Like the scene that Hoberman objected to, he's kind of my go-to, what do you call it, straw man, because he's always attacking the Coen brothers for the wrong reasons. He's like Bosley Crowther of today when it comes to the Coen brothers. But but he said this, the scene where the Indian is being hanged and is a True Grit, and he was upset because they throw a hood over the guy's head as he's trying to talk, and then he falls, you know, he drops and dies. Yeah. Well, that's the whole point, is they won't let him say anything because he's an Indian, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hoberman thinks it's some kind of outrageous racist thing or whatever. I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
And critics are really dumb sometimes.
I was just thinking that if I... What inspired you, or wondering what inspired you to do this summary piece? One could suppose that either the Coens are in a slump period or a slumber period, and because the last real feature was Hail Caesar, and I think that The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is actually quite good, but it is an anthology film, so I don't really see it in the same light. How do you regard that film, by the way?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful film. I think it's one of their best. I mean, it's about seven different films together, but it's a mixture. To me, it's a real culmination, and I wrote this before they kind of announced that they're not working together for a while, at least. It seemed like they were making a kind of testament film or culmination film, like a lot of directors do when they reach the end of their careers, although the Coens are only in their 60s and they hopefully have a long way to go. But it shows all their range. You know, there's broad comedy and there's absurdism, like at the beginning, the episode with the cowboy, and then a dark comedy. And then it has a really serious straight drama with the wagon train episode is really wonderful, I think. Very beautiful and moving and sad and dark. And then there's a really... absurdist comedy, dark comedy at the end where they're in the stagecoach. At first I didn't quite understand it, but then I realized they're in the afterworld, afterlife, you know. It's quite clear. They're going into this, it's all totally abstract, stylistically, and then they go into this hotel. It's kind of like heaven or hell or whatever it's supposed to be, and it's the end of the line for everybody in the world. But I find that beautiful. But yeah, Hail Caesar, you're right, it's the last of their complete features, although that film is very it's sort of like a bunch of skits, isn't it? I mean, like, one thing that is wonderful is that gay musical number with the sailors.
Everybody loves that, sure.
Yeah, everybody loves that, but I felt the film was not totally satisfactory. It just sort of didn't hang together with... I didn't quite understand the central character. I mean, I know they love to play games with reality, but they call the guy Eddie Mannix, and the real Eddie Mannix was a notorious thug in a lot of ways.
Yeah, a fixer.
But they made this guy like a Christ figure who is kind of thuggish, but he's trying to help people. He's trying to, you know, help bring order to people's lives.
Yeah.
Why call him Eddie Mannix? I mean, I think it's just sort of a really inside joke that maybe a few people would get, but that didn't bother me that much, but the film didn't hang together. It's sort of like a series of episodes.
I agree with you. Hey, what do you, well, you know, if one thing that I can rely upon the Coens, they really know cinematography, they know all the technical stuff. They're perfect in terms of that. Making things look right and sound right. Why would they show us scenes from what's supposed to be Quo Vadis, the Robert Taylor thing in 51, within in a kind of a widescreen or 1:85 aspect ratio, when back then it was purely, Academy ratio, 1:37. They know that, but they decided to ignore that. I thought that was so strange.
Well, they could have done it that way, you're right. I mean, but I think that, I mean, a lot of their work is sort of playing games with style and reality. For example, just the fact that Fargo is a city in North Dakota, mm-hmm. or is it South Dakota, and in they make a film called Fargo that takes place in Minnesota, you know, but just because they like the name Fargo, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that when they're actually North Dakota, I just looked it up here. Mm. But in terms of the old Hollywood scene, the MGM films that they're making fun of in that film, you know, I think they're kind of viewing it through the prism of their, you know, the style today. I always think period films are kind of about the present day anyway. Otherwise, why would you make a period film, you know?
Yeah.
They're kind of disguised commentaries on the modern world in one way or another. And although, I mean, they have a great nostalgia for the old Hollywood, and they know it really well.
Yeah.
And that whole scene where the director, who's kind of like Minnelli or Lubitsch, is trying to teach that guy, the cowboy actor, how to say one line is really wonderful.
That's hilarious. I love that. That's Ralph Fiennes and what's his name, who played Han Solo.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the actor. Let me look it up. Yeah, that's so wonderful. I mean, little things. I mean, that's a long sort of extended scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a riff on the romantic comedies of Lubitsch and Minnelli or whoever. Let me just... Oh, Aidan Ehrenreich.
Alden Ehrenreich,
it's the guy, Hobie Doyle, who plays the cowboy character. Mm-hmm. Would that it were so simple, I guess is all right. This is great.
Yeah.
So it has these wonderful scenes, but that film, in my view, doesn't hold together. But some of the other ones, you know, I guess they are kind of directors of vignettes. Somebody mentioned that about Ford, that he's... His films are composed of a lot of vignettes. Mm-hmm. That's kind of true. But the Coen brothers, it's like they have a lot of little films within the film.
Mm-hmm.
And they're different styles sometimes, too. And, you know, that works for me.
Stepping back from the films that they have made, what is your suspicion or insight about where they are now? And I understand that the reason that Ethan... did not want to do Macbeth with Joel is because he saw it as a basically something that Frances wanted Joel to do for her because she wanted to play Lady Macbeth, and he was basically obliging her, and I guess they were felt that they were kind of at a dry spot, so he figured, well, I'll do the Macbeth, and then you and I, Ethan, we can talk about something later. Is that what you understand?
It's kind of mysterious because there was an interview with Joel in the New York Times the other day. You probably saw that. Where
actually, I didn't.
He made one comment that I thought was very interesting. He said, "You know, when we started our careers, we weren't planning necessarily to work as a brother team for 40 years," which I thought was kind of a good insight.
Huh.
They started out making films together, but they didn't necessarily. He said, "We don't really plan. We didn't plan our career. It just happened, you know, that way."
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, Ethan is the one who's written books of poetry and short stories and...
some theater,
I mean,
right?
Joel... Hmm?
Also some theater, I think, Ethan?
Yeah, he's done plays, that's right, done plays, and that's what... you know, they haven't really commented on it too much, but in my book I quote Carter Burwell, their composer, is saying that Ethan wanted to... let's see, Ethan just didn't want to make movies anymore. Ethan seems very happy doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But he's wants to do more plays and writing. But you're probably right. I was thinking of that Frances McDormand did Macbeth here in Berkeley, I believe. And you know, but on the other hand, maybe, I don't know, they haven't really... One thing I like about them, frankly, is that they don't explain a lot to the audience, to the public. It's like John Ford refused to tell people what the hell he was doing, and that was the first interview I had in Hollywood, and it was very exasperating. I was somewhat prepared for him being difficult, but I didn't know how completely difficult he would be, and I kind of respect that now, because what Ford was doing was kind of implying to the audience that I'm not going to tell you what to think of my films, you have to watch them and make up your own mind about them, which I think is good, actually, because most directors today give 100 interviews. I mean, especially with the award circuit, they're all over the place explaining their intentions. And the Coen brothers just basically make the films and say, you figure it out for yourself, which I think is a sign of respect for the audience. But it sometimes leads to confusion, you know, and that's one, I guess that's one reason I wrote this book. I think that, you know, I tend to want to write books because I feel there's some injustice or neglect going on. Either a filmmaker is neglected, like Lubitsch was somewhat neglected, although he has a following, but a lot of people never heard of him, and, you know, his films, when I started my book, the films weren't as widely seen as they are now, but the Coens have certainly gotten a lot of awards, and they have a lot of fans, but I think they're seriously misunderstood by some critics and some audience members, and I wanted to deal with those issues, and that's one reason I wrote this. This was an unusual book for me because, you know, I wrote it in a thematic structure without, it's not film by film by film. Like I used to write critical studies. I did one on Wells and Ford and with Mike Wilmington, who died recently, and I did the Lubitsch book, and I tended to go chronologically, but then I thought, well, I'll write this book about the Coens and just focus on the you know, the few points that I want to make or the key things I want to say and jump around from film to film to illustrate.
Well, you jumped around in the Wilder book too, no? Did you not jump around with the Wilder book also a little bit? I mean, I thought it was wonderful that you didn't jump, that you didn't go sequential and that you were floating around from theme to theme, and I thought that was great.
Good, I'm glad you liked that. And well, I'll tell you, Jessica, see, the thing was, the Coen book influenced the Wilder book, oddly enough, even though the Wilder book came out in October and the Coen book is coming out in March. I wrote a lot of the Coen's book back in 2017. If you notice on the copyright page, I did this book called Two Cheers for Hollywood. You may have a copy of that.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I got it right here.
Yeah, it's a collection of my work, and I decided, you know, I was going to collect my work, which I wanted to for a long time, but I wanted to include some new things because I wanted the book to be, you know, have some new treats for people. And I thought, okay, I've been wanting to write about the Coen brothers for a long time. So I wrote a long, in effect, a monograph about them. It's about 40 pages in that book, in big pages. And so I what I did was I sat down and watched all the Coen brothers films in about 2 weeks, and I purposely watched them out of order. I don't know, I just felt maybe it'd be more interesting to watch them out of order, and that contributed to this thematic approach. And I had a lot of fun writing it that way, and I kind of thought, you know, I got tired of the chronological approach, which I think is kind of old-fashioned. And then, so the Wilder book, I started working on that back in 2009, and I was going to do a book on Lubitsch and Wilder together, and I worked on it for a while that way, and then I realized that, first of all, they're quite different, even though they're similar, and the book would be way too long and cumbersome to cut back and forth. So I put Wilder aside, and I did Lubitsch, but when I went back to really finish the Wilder book, if you notice, in the first half of the Wilder book, it's pretty chronological from his youth to, you know, his journalism and then his screenwriting in Germany and the screenwriting in Hollywood. And then the second half is about his directing in Hollywood. And I kept thinking, how am I going to do this? And I thought, I really don't want to do the chronological approach because it's tedious. And I think somehow you lose some insights if you're not connecting all the films.
Yeah, exactly.
Because when we watch these films, we're not watching them chronologically anymore. You know, we would if we were back in the day, you know, and they made one film after another. We're jumping around and watching whatever we want to watch, and all the films of an artist are related. So I had already done the main body of the Coens book, except for the Buster Scruggs section, and then I was doing the Wilder thing. So the Coens book actually influenced how I did the Wilder book. You know, that's a good insight you had. Yeah.
Was there any reaching out to these guys as part of a possible addendum where you could just discuss things as they are now? Is that something you tried to do, or what was the...
No, I didn't feel the need to. You know, I mean, when I started, I did critical studies, and then I moved into biographies, and, you know, I did three big biographies, Capra, Ford and Spielberg, and I spent a lot of time. I spent a whole year interviewing Capra off and on, and then I interviewed Ford once, which was really helpful to me. Even though he didn't say much, I learned a lot from being in his presence for an hour. And then Spielberg, I asked for an interview, and he said through his, you know, Marvin Levy, his spokesman, that he said he knew my work and respected it, but he was saving it for his autobiography, is the line he uses. And he wouldn't give me an interview for the book. And I felt that was okay, because he's given so many interviews, I could find a quote from him on just about every subject, you know. And the thing he did that was helpful, though, when people called him, I interviewed over 300 people for that book, and they would call him up and say, should I talk to McBride? And his office would tell them I'm kosher, is what they were told, which I thought was very helpful. And, you know, I got to a lot of people that way, but some people wouldn't talk to me. Like, I found the people who were most skittish about talking about him were actors, and, you know, like Richard Dreyfuss didn't reply, and people like that. And And the more recently they had worked with Spielberg, the less likely they were to talk. The people who worked with him, you know, a long time ago, are really eager to talk about what they did with him. But, you know, actors are very timid people by nature, I think. And so, I mean, it became, you know, I got to whoever I could get to. But I didn't feel the need to talk to Spielberg himself, because, you know, I had an endless supply of Spielberg quotes.
Right.
And but with when I do a critical study, I did interview Billy Wilder a lot. I mean, I was really fascinated by Billy Wilder. And at one point, for a number of years, I used to think it'd be fun to do an interview book with Wilder, like I did with Howard Hawks. And I never really asked him, though. I mean, it was strange, because I kept thinking about it, and I never really approached him on that. And I didn't realize Cameron Crowe was doing it. You know, he did that book on Wilder.
Sure.
But I did interview Wilder for Film Comment with Todd McCarthy, and I interviewed him for Variety on various occasions. And I was on the set of The Front Page, and I did a couple of articles on that. And so I got to know him, and that really helped. I got to ask him a lot of questions. But certainly, you know, Lubitsch, he died the year I was born. But one thing I found with the Lubitsch book was really valuable. At the Academy Library, they have a lot of press releases that Paramount put out when Lubitsch was working there, and they're really good. They're like articles, because whoever did them would interview Lubitsch, and he had very thoughtful quotes, and nobody had really found these since they came out. So I was able to find all these unknown quotes from Lubitsch about his art form, you know. But with the Coens, you know, I mean, their interviews are not really very helpful. There is a book of Coen Brothers interviews that's interesting, and the thing that I found intriguing is that they tend to be more open when they speak to foreign interviewers, especially in France, where they're really big in France. And they kind of, I think they have a kind of a contempt for American culture.
Sure.
You know, somebody said to them once, what is it, Burn After Reading, is it a lesson to Americans? And I think Joel said, everything we do is a lesson to Americans. And Billy Wilder said that about The Apartment, actually. He said it was a, how did he put it? He said, he was accused by some critic of sentimentality in The Apartment, and he said, you know, he did everything possible to avoid sentimentality. He said, I portray Americans as beasts. That was quite shocking. You know?
Yeah.
but it is pretty rough on Americans. But I don't know. Recently, I showed Avanti, which I love, to some friends of mine who hadn't seen it, and these people were retired Berkeley professors, and one person said afterwards, this film is unfair to Italians, and I tried to explain why ethnic humor can still be entertaining, and he didn't buy it. And then my other friend, who is a retired Berkeley professor, said, this film is unfair to Americans, and I couldn't believe she was saying that. Unfair to Americans? I mean, it makes fun of the ugly American character,
yeah,
you know.
The Jack Lemmon character. The first thing he says when he gets to that beautiful hotel, well, it certainly doesn't look or like a Hilton to me.
Yeah.
And the concierge says, thank you for the compliment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a wonderful satire of the ugly American cult. And, you know, Wilder gave an interview to a French critic, and he said this film is a real critique of American culture, and the the more you look at the film, it has a lot of political overtones. And it was made during the Nixon period, and there's a lot of jokes about Nixon, and it's very satirical. But the Coen brothers, again, they're very critical of American culture. And but when they go to Europe, they're more expansive in their interviews. But but I didn't really feel the need to, you know, I don't think that we should necessarily be taking what the artists say about their work as the last word either. I mean, I think that's a flaw a lot of people have is, you know, Kubrick told Spielberg, he said, never tell the press what your intent is when you make a film because that's all they will talk about.
Right.
And Kubrick famously never really did that. Hardly at all, except there's that one interview I think you can see on YouTube where he's talking to some guy on the phone. Have you seen that one? To a Japanese critic?
Yes. You're talking about an audio tape, yes?
Yeah, he talks about the ending of 2001.
Yeah,
He's very explicit about it.
That's a pretty interesting...
That's very unusual for him.
Yeah, yeah.
But Spielberg, the only time he violated that advice was for Munich, because I think he felt Munich was such a sensitive political topic that he had to be really clear about what he was intending. So he gave a long interview to Richard Schickel for Time magazine. They did a cover on it, and yet he still got attacked from both sides, you know, for that film, predictably. And so the Coens, I don't think, want to play that game of explaining things. They just let people make up their own minds. But the problem with that, and it's been observed of John Ford too, that there are some confusions about Ford's attitudes because he didn't give you explanations, and so therefore it becomes necessary for critics, I think, to do that job and help people understand these artists. You know, you can disagree with my book or whatever, but at least I make an effort to try to. And you know, I structured the book around counteracting detractors' comments, which I thought was a good rhetorical ploy. My son goes to Stanford, and he said one of his professors said, you know, a great rhetorical device is quote somebody you don't agree with and then attack him. And actually, I learned that from Jesuit priests when I went to a Catholic Jesuit high school in Milwaukee, and they taught us how to defend our faith, basically, but it was good rhetorical devices. What they said was basically get the other person to express his point of view and then tear it apart and destroy it, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking about the your point about the Coens feel that every film that they've made is a scolding or a lecture to American culture. But one could, I mean, there's really no way to not conclude that their attitude towards the Jewish community that they grew up in near the suburb.
Yeah.
But if it were made by a non-Jewish person, it would probably be accused of being anti-Semitic, because there's every cliche and every type, if you will, of Jewish figure in a Hebrew community. It's just relentless, the mockery that they throw in the direction of these people, these characters that they've created. Do you agree?
Well, yeah, I mean, they were accused of anti-Semitism. I mean, there is, you know... Woody Allen gets sometimes accused of Jewish anti-Semitism, they call it, where people who are Jewish, you know, criticize their own people, and then they get attacked for it. But, I mean, my feeling is, I mean, I'm an ex-Catholic, renegade ex-Catholic, and if I were to make a film about Catholicism, it would be really harsh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a way, people of a group have more facility or more right to deal with it. I mean, everybody should be able to criticize anything, in my opinion, but when Jewish filmmakers deal with their own background, I mean, I found a short story by Ethan, which I quote in the book, that's quite critical about, it's about a Jewish kid growing up and being indoctrinated in Hebrew school, and he's really indifferent to it or hostile to it. And I could identify with that because that's how I became about Catholicism. But you remember in Serious Man, the guy's son is going through bar mitzvah and he really doesn't care about it. And he gets stoned. And they have a scene where there's a bar mitzvah seen through the eyes of a kid who's
yeah.
which is pretty funny, but I suppose some people might be offended by it. But there's an interesting interview with the Coen brothers on on the DVD for Serious Man where they're kind of kidding about, they were kind of saying with a twinkle in their eye, oh, we're not trying to offend anybody, but they obviously are being very mischievous. But, you know, I mean, they grew up in that world. They're saying what they felt. And they have that very funny line in the credits at the end that no Jews were harmed during the making of this picture. Which is sort of, I think, their attitude. But I think that, you know, to me, I think you love that guy in the film. He's such a lovable character, and so many terrible things happen to the poor guy. At one point, he shouts, "I'm not a bad man." You know, I don't think we think he's a bad man, and all these injustices happen to him. And so there's a real affection for him, at least, if not for some of the people who torment him.
Well, the whole crux of the humor in that film is, "I'm not a bad man. Why does God seem to treat me this way?" And the answer is God doesn't give a shit at all, you know, because God's in a bad mood, you know, or whatever.
Well, you know, in the film, he goes to see three rabbis, and they are totally unhelpful, you know.
Yeah.
And in the book of Job, what it is he goes to see three friends, and they're totally unhelpful because nobody can really answer these questions about God.
Mm.
And one of the rabbis in Serious Man says something about how God is unfathomable and we can't understand him. And that's really kind of the problem that they're exploring in the film, is we don't understand God. You know, and in Elie Wiesel's Night, which is about his time in Auschwitz, there's a powerful scene where they see a child being hanged at Auschwitz. It's the worst possible thing you can imagine. And the Jews who are witnessing this are saying, where is God? How could there be a God if you permit something like this to happen? And that's kind of what they're asking in that film. And there is no real answer to that, but I think artists don't answer questions. They pose questions for us, you know?
Well, I really do think there is an answer in that film, and that is that God is a son of a bitch who doesn't care about anything.
Well, or he's indifferent, you know, like John Huston suggested, that maybe indifference of God.
Yeah.
Or hostile. You could... people wonder about that. I mean, that's a serious theological issue, and I think that there are serious filmmakers. It's a black comedy, in a sense, gallows humor, but it's a very serious film, too, as the title might suggest.
Yeah.
You know? But I like all that. I like their irreverence. They're very irreverent, and, you know, I talk about... They like ethnic humor, and, you know, I mean, you and I are always... I mean, that's a very fraught thing, obviously, today. If you're not supposed to have any ethnic humor in your films or whatever, but they don't worry about that. They just have a lot of fun with ethnic cliches and stereotypes, and they make fun of the stereotypes. But my feeling has always been, and this is true of John Ford too, that if you have a kind of a warm fellow feeling toward people, you can make fun of people without being cruel, you know, but the Coens get accused of cruelty, and I don't think they are most of the time, because I think they love these characters, like the woman in The Lady Killers, the woman played by Irma P. Hall, is such a great actress, and she's, some people think it's horrible because she's a black lady that she's giving her money to Bob Jones University, you know. that's such a great touch, I think, because she's very innocent, and there's this kind of sweetness about her that she's giving her money to this racist institution without realizing it, and that offended some people, but I think it's just kind of a commentary on human nature that she's this innocent person and she's being taken advantage of, you know.
Did you happen to touch at all in your book, which I haven't read enough of for me to talk with any authority here, but I wanted to just ask you if you had gotten into the Jen Yamato interview of 2016 when they were doing interviews for Hail Caesar. Did you touch upon that?
No, I don't know what that is. Who is Jen Yamato?
She is with the Times now, LA Times. She was with the Daily Beast at the time. And she tried to hold Joel and Ethan's feet to the fire, so to speak, because of a lack of diversity in the cast of Hail Caesar. Of course, there was from a time in Hollywood in which people of color were at best allowed to play maids or butlers or that sort of thing. And she said to them in so many words, "Now come on, fellas, this is 2016. Now this, do you or do you not feel that it's important to have diversity in your films these days? Diversity is very important these days." And they said, "What the fuck are you talking about? You don't know what you don't know what movies are, or how they work, or you're coming from a really weird place. I mean, I don't understand what your question. I mean, I understand the question, but what are you talking about?" And it was fairly hostile. They really kind of shut her down. And then 5 years later, Joel makes Macbeth, and he basically makes it 50-60% African American. So he flips over and does this whole representation thing just because Denzel's in it. He doesn't want Denzel to be the only person of color. But it's funny, they really hostile the idea of playing along with what everybody wants these days, which is diversity. And then he completely flipped over and,
Yeah, I don't think they did it because they were feeling pressure. I mean, I've seen other interviews too where they say basically, we don't have a quota system in our casting that's absurd. We just write the characters we feel like writing, and we cast whoever we feel like casting, and we don't feel any need to follow any rules or anything. But I mean, certainly in Hail Caesar, it was a lily white atmosphere in Hollywood, and they reflect that in their films. I remember when Poitier died, I was thinking back in his autobiography, he said when he first stepped foot on the MGM lot, the only other black person on the lot was the shoeshine man who they call Slick'em.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, can you imagine? He was Slick'em, the only other black person. So it was an all white world. But in Macbeth, I think it's so stylized, Shakespeare is so stylized, it doesn't matter who plays what if they're a good actor. That's the main point.
That's got an excellent cast all around. I really love that film for the casting is wonderful. Everybody is good. Everybody, Joe's chose very well, including Frances.
Yeah.
She's really good as well. So.
Wonderful. Well, I think that, I think you have a good point that I think they wanted to work with Denzel Washington, and he's done a bunch of Shakespeare on the stage, mm-hmm. They might have felt, if he's the only black person in the film, it would be kind of making a point of some kind. They didn't want to make a point about blackness or whiteness. They just wanted to have good actors in the film. But so they had some other actors who were black in the film, but they just wanted to cast people they like to work with.
Yeah,
But it also kind of rhymes with him, Macbeth, mm-hmm. Macduff's wife. I think Macduff was black too, wasn't he? The guy who plays Macduff. Let me take a look here.
Who I really liked in that cast was the guy who played Ross, R-O-S-S.
Yeah, Ross was... that was a very unusual character. Interesting, they expanded on Ross to some extent. Let me just take a look. Mm. Ross was an African-American guy, and Macduff, Corey Hawkins is black, and then Moses Ingram is very striking as Lady Macduff, And so I think that to have various black characters in there is kind of fits the scheme of the story. And it's all very abstract. I mean, that's a very abstract film, kind of like Wells' Macbeth or Kurosawa's Throne of Blood. In Shakespeare, colorblind casting is common on the stage. In films, it's less common until recently because... film is a photographic medium, and people expect some realism. But the Coens are not particularly realistic directors in any of their films, really. I suppose you could say No Country for Old Men is somewhat realistic. But the way the serial killer kills people with that weapon is very bizarre, But there's a certain reality-based feeling in that film that you believe in the sheriff and the people, the other minor characters.
Well, you kind of sidestepped.
Films are very stylized, and so in a way, it doesn't matter who they cast as long as they want to cast the actor.
If there's one thing that you can say is good about now, I mean, it's a horrible era that we're living through in terms of the death of theatrical and everything. But at the very least, lots of stuff is getting made. There's a lot of content. The streaming services are saying yes to a lot of different things. So.
Mm-hmm.
we can at least say that if the Coens wanted to get back in the saddle and do what they used to do, or try to do it, they certainly wouldn't have any difficulty getting Netflix to go along with it, or Amazon, or whomever, Hulu.
Yeah.
But they don't. That's the question, though. I'm really being an addict and a friend, and I feel simpatico with these guys. I really don't want them to stop making films. And
no, I don't either, and I hope that they work together. But mm-hmm. they may just be a little. I think Joel said it feels good to take kind of a rest, separation.
Uh-huh.
But I don't really know. We're not privy to their inside thoughts. It'd be interesting if they ever wrote an autobiography or something. But they don't feel they have to share that with us. But I hope they work together. But Netflix has been great for Spike Lee has found a home at Netflix too, and he's like one of my favorite contemporary filmmakers, and he's had an up and down track record mm-hmm. commercially, as everybody has. And then Wells with Other Side of the Wind, I'll always be grateful to Netflix for finishing that Wells film. And so I think it's a great place for the Coens if they want to make another film. I'm sure they could do it at Netflix. And Ballad of Buster Scruggs, I think, is a great film. And I saw it first on Netflix, and then I went to the theater because it had a limited theatrical run. And I almost felt it played better on television, strangely enough.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't gain... Some films, like West Side Story, I saw streaming, and then I went to a theater, and it plays better on the big screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think a musical, the scale of the musical really benefits from the big screen, but... Buster Scruggs, I don't know, it just played fine in both media, Mike Nichols worked before he died on TV a lot. Cable TV was a good home for him, and a lot of good filmmakers are, cable TV and streaming are the home of intelligent adult filmmaking if you're interested in characters and dialogue, and Spike Lee and the Coens are both, they're great visual stylists. I think people don't talk about Spike Lee's visuals as much as they should, but he's a terrific visual stylist,
So it can be fair to say that Joe McBride did not focus on this question that is so dominating the thinking of Coen Brothers fans. Like, are these guys done, or are they coming back? So you did not focus on that. You just figure whatever happens, happens, right?
Well, what happened, Jeff, I wrote the body of the book in 2017, then I decided, what I basically decided was, the book is out there, it was part of the book Two Cheers for Hollywood, which keeps selling, but I thought it should be a standalone book on the Coen brothers. I thought it would get more attention that way, and I began thinking about that and adding Buster Scruggs to that, because that came along after I wrote my initial essay, and so I thought if you combine those two, that would make a good book, and this publisher, Anthem Press, approached me and said, would you like to do a book? And I said, yeah, the Coen brothers. And they said, great. And then after I finished writing this, the Buster Scruggs was a complex film to write about. It was a 7-part film, and I really had fun writing about it. But I finished all that, and then they announced their separation. So I dealt with that in the prologue. A note to the reader is like, what I call it, you can look that up there, where I just mentioned that they're going their separate ways for a while, and we don't know, and I don't think they even know what the future will hold. So actually, it turns out to be a very good time to take stock of their work, because maybe they'll never do a film together again. And
but they've got a brand. What are they going to do? Become gardeners?
It's very good sometimes to write a book about somebody when their career is still going strong, because people wait often until long after somebody is retired or died or whatever, and critical opinion has congealed. But it's more interesting to try to plunge in and shape opinion, or it takes more daring, to write about people in the midst of their career, as I did with Spielberg. And I felt he was really badly treated by the critics when I was writing that book. And since then, he's been treated better. And, he was shunned by the Academy for a long time. But that's changed. But I think my book helped change that. And I hope to clarify some of the issues about the Coen brothers' work that confuse certain reviewers and cause some people to really hate them. I think their work is uneven, and certain films of theirs I don't like, but they get some real hostility from some critics, which I think
you said that in the early part of the interview, and that was primarily due to A Serious Man, and what other films made the haters out of people?
Well, I was mentioning the ending of No Country for Old Men, which you and I both like a lot. I know some people, you know, you read on various websites or you hear people talk about it, they really get upset about the ending because, I mean, Sam Fuller once told me, he said, he said that a filmmaker lives and dies for the last 5 minutes of his film because that's where he makes his statement.
Yeah.
And he said that it's no coincidence that that's the part of the film that the studio is always trying to change because he said they want to make it their statement. But he said, and other people have said this too, that if a film has a bad ending, you know, no matter how good the film is, people are going to go out unhappy and complain to their friends. And vice versa, if a film is sort of, you know, uneven and has a great ending, that's what you remember.
Sure.
So endings are terribly important. So I think a lot of people felt mystified by the ending of No Country for Old Men. But, you know, it's an unusual ending because it's not a plot thing. It's about what goes on in this man's mind. And but that's what the film is about, is this righteous lawman who believes in the law, and he realizes that the modern world doesn't follow these rules anymore.
That's precisely the conversation that I had with Ethan at the Cannes Film Festival the day after it had its big screening at the Palais, and I had that exact same conversation. He said, "Well, what do you think the ending is?" I said, "Well, it's about how the system of reliance and trust and decency, all that stuff is becoming eroded, and it's represented by Anton Chigurh and his way of dealing with life," and Ethan go, you know. So that's exactly what they're saying.
You nailed it, and it's about and who does he remind me of? Well, I mean, he's like the guy in A Serious Man in that he's a decent, serious scholar in that film, and he's trying to teach people about science, and the world is totally out of control, and he's trying to make sense, you know, he's trying to make sense out of the world in an ethical way, and he can't.
Yeah.
And the same with Tommy Lee Jones in No Country for Old Men. He's trying to maintain order, but he realizes the world is spiraled out of control, and evil is running rampant. Mm. And that's part of what they deal with in their films. And there are a number of other films. Inside Llewyn Davis is about the artist and how difficult it is to be an artist in our culture. And, you know, and that guy is—he's probably the author of his own misery, but he's not a great artist like Bob Dylan. That's part of the point of the ending, I think, is that Llewyn Davis is a fairly good artist, but he's not a great artist like Bob Dylan. But he's—you know—one of the most devastating scenes in the film is when he goes to Chicago to see the impresario played by F. Murray Abraham, and the guy says,
I don't see a lot of money in this.
I don't see a lot of money, right?
You know, all through the movie, it's like I want to reach in to the movie, grab him by the lapels and say, "Listen, man, come on, just stop looking back and singing standards. Mix your own life, all the stuff you're going through, and make that what your songs are about." But, you know, stop going and redoing Joe Hill all the time. And it was, and it's so maddening that you can't do that, and you have to just watch him go down, 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 and more into despair because he can't find the art that's transcendent about what he could be doing, you know?
Yeah, no, I think you're one of the people who really understand the Coens. That's a really good point. That I think they're critical of that guy, even though they love that guy and they identify with him, but he's not a great artist, and you're right, he's unable to take his own miserable flaws and failings and make serious art about it. He makes pretty good art, but not good enough, you know, I think. You know, and so the line that F. Murray Abraham says, "I don't see a lot of money here," you know, and as I said, it's a line you can readily imagine the Coens have heard many times from studio executives, you know. One reason that they're successful is they get most of their funding, or they have a lot of times, from Europe. If you look at the credits of their films, they get a lot of funding from France and other European countries. And to me, they're remarkable in that they manage to make such personal films in the system that is really geared against personal filmmaking. And very few people are doing that these days. I mean, Spielberg has the clout to do that because he has so much money and autonomy. But The Coens do it, and a few other people. Spike Lee does it, and, but it's a real struggle in American film today. I mean, it was always a struggle, but it's worse now than it ever was because the mainstream market is so schlocky, and everybody's making Marvel movies, you know. And Scorsese manages to keep his personal filmmaking alive, but very few people are able to do that, and the Coens are able to. But part of it is because they're supported by foreign money. But Netflix is different. I mean, they are supported by Netflix, or they can. I'm sure, as you say, if they had a project and they went in tomorrow, they could get it made by Netflix, you know.
By the way, let me just conclude on this, because I don't want to go too much over an hour, and we've done that. Have you had a chance to hear about the Fagelmans, the Spielberg film that is going to come out sometime? Is that this year or next year, the Fagelmans?
Oh, it's coming out in the fall of this year, and like in October, November, I forget which. But it's, you know, I've been trying to figure out the plot. This is a little off track, but based on some clues, you know, everybody assumed it would be about his Arizona period because they, at first they said it was going to be filmed in Phoenix, and then it turned out not to be filmed in Phoenix. And
I thought it was going to be about the making of that film that he finally showed at a drive-in and all that, right? That kind of the alien visitation film.
Well, that's, Firelight. I would have thought that would be a really interesting film, the making of Firelight.
Yeah.
But, see, he didn't make this film in Phoenix, after all, and I was following in the Arizona Republic, and they were saying it's going to be made in Phoenix, and then it wasn't, but... I think, you know, frankly, I could be wrong about this, so I don't want to be, I mean, just between you and me.
Yeah.
I think it's probably more about his senior year at Saratoga High School, which I write a whole chapter about in my book, and the chapter is called Hell on Earth. That's what Spielberg called it. And I think that would be a really interesting film because that's the period when he was tormented by anti-Semitic people, and it was really a tough year for him, and his parents broke up that year.
And, his mother was had a boyfriend, right? Wasn't that what was happening?
Yeah, I figured out the story, and then the parents finally talked about it in public that Leah, his mother, fell in love with their friend Bernie Adler.
Right.
And Stephen misunderstood that, and I got the story from his friends that he blamed his mother at the time, but later he blamed his father, and he had a long period where he was angry at his father, and then I realized that the father was a good guy, and part of it, my point in the book was to try to reconcile Stephen with his father, and it seemed to help, you know, because I wrote about how supportive his father actually was of his filmmaking and stuff, and how the mother fell in love with this man, but Arnold was a workaholic, and he admitted that, you know, but, you know, there's always blame on both sides. But anyway, that was a very traumatic year for Stephen, and I get the sense that that's what this film is about. I could be wrong, though.
But let me just understand fully.
Clues.
Firelight was made before his senior year, you're saying?
Yeah, he made Firelight. It premiered in February. I'm sorry, when was it? I think it was February of 64. The day before he left Phoenix, it premiered Firelight.
Okay.
And then he went to Saratoga High School and graduated in the spring of 65. So Saratoga was his senior year, basically. And he spent a little time in another Northern California school, but he went to Saratoga High School, which is up here near San Jose. And he was tormented by anti-Semitic guys and stuff. It was a tough year for him. And I think that's what this film is about. I get the impression because... based on some photographs and some other clues.
Okay.
And it was shot in Southern California. And, you know, the whole beach scenes, you've probably seen those photographs. That is clearly to me, he made a film called Senior Sneak Day, which in the at the end of his senior year, they all went to the San Jose Boardwalk, which is kind of like Coney Island or something. And Stephen made a funny film of all the kids cavorting on the beach, and you could see in the photographs that this Spielberg character is making the film of these jocks and pretty girls running around the beach, you know.
But it does have a lot of the...
And also that would interest Tony Kushner more, you know, than the making of Firelight, with, you know, a more serious drama would interest Tony Kushner more than The Making of Firelight, I think, you know.
Because it is called The Fagelman, so, and there is an uncle figure, not just the father and the mother breaking up, but also an uncle figure. So there's, it sounds like, you know, family dynamic is what it seems to be mainly.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, some of it is different from the actual circumstances of Stephen's life, too. For whatever reason, he decided to fictionalize it. Which, I mean, Truffaut did that. I was thinking in 400 Blows, he fictionalized the kid to some extent, even though that's his own story.
Yeah.
You know, and he also changed the time period. And, you know, people do that sometimes when they do autobiographical things.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really know the whole story. They're keeping a lid on it right now. But, you know, it's interesting. He's being mysterious about it. But, you know, photographs emerge from the shooting.
Sure.
But anyway, one thing, by the way, if you wouldn't mind mentioning, I have three other books out right now. When you do this piece, if you could slip in a reference to this. I have four books out at once here.
The Wilder, the Coens, the and
yeah, I have a my Orson Welles book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles,
right.
A Portrait of an Independent Career.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you actually the covers for the books. That I did an updated edition of that, which came out in, earlier this month.
Okay.
And then I did a book that was a long-term project that came out last month called Political Truth, The Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy.
Oh, fascinating. And, I'm sorry. I didn't know about that, Joe.
Yeah, that was a big project that I spent decades studying. I mean, I always studied the Kennedy assassination. I wrote a book on it in 2013 called Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit.
Right.
But all along the way, I was studying the media because I'm a media critic and journalist. I've been a journalist since 1960, and I'm fascinated by how the media lie to us about the assassination. So I've been researching that. I started working on that book in the 90s, and then I went back to it and finished it and put it out. I worked on it for the last couple of years before December, and it came out in December.
Okay.
But I'll send you the cover so you can
thank
see
you.
What I've been doing.
That's good.
Anyway, well, thank you for interviewing me. This is the first interview on the Cone book, by the way, so thank you.
Okay. So you want me to wait, of course, until just before publication, which is, once again, March what?
Well, it's March 1st. I was thinking about that. You know, whatever you feel like, Jeff, you know, if you want to run it sooner, it's fine with me because it gets anticipation going. You don't really have to wait till the day it comes out or anything.
So it's mid-February is cool, then, you're saying.
And also, actually, this way you get the scoop if you want to run it earlier rather than wait.
Sure.
You know, because I've been doing a lot of podcasts and stuff, and somebody might call me up and do a podcast or an interview, and you might as well be the first, you know.
Sure. Thanks. All right, Joe. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Okay, you take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Automatic voice message system 310-614-8814 is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang.